The Tea Health Show, your medical lifestyle podcast, brought to you by The Tea Clinic.
Good morning, I'm Dr. Mark. This is The Tea Health Show. And October being Breast Cancer Awareness Month, we're going to focus on some problems that only women or the majority of women can face. I have invited oncologist Dr. Owen Nosworthy to join me, and today we're going to talk about breast cancer. Owen, it's good to have you back in the studio.
Yeah, thanks for having me back.
So we are hearing more and more people being diagnosed with cancer. But before we answer that question, explain to us exactly what is cancer.
So cancer basically is when you have an uncontrolled overgrowth of what we would consider a normal body tissue. And by definition, it is an, or should I say the definition between a benign tumor and a malignant tumor, for example, is it an overgrowth of the cells is a benign tumor, but the minute that it invades or damages another tissue or spreads into a different part of the body, then it becomes malignant or cancer. And it basically, the reason that this happens is varied. In a lot of cases, it can be in response to some sort of stimuli, can be in response to some damage to the tissues or the cells from radiation or all sorts of causative factors. And sometimes it's genetic.
Okay, so the incidence of cancer is skyrocketing. I read a paper recently that, for instance, the incidence of colorectal cancer has increased by 79% in the last 30 years, which is shocking.
Yeah.
Now, why are we seeing such an increase in cancer?
So, you know, there's always been this query, well, was cancer always around and it just wasn't diagnosed? But that's not really the case. So we definitely are seeing an increased incidence, without a doubt. The causes are multitude. But if we had to look at probably, if we could narrow it down to one broad group, we'd say it's lifestyle. You know, lifestyle Absolutely. Affects a massive, it's a huge, huge risk factor in terms of cancer development. And that includes lack of exercise, diet, particularly diet plays a huge role when it comes to colorectal cancer, smoking, you know, excessive alcohol use. So it's lifestyle. Our lifestyles have changed dramatically and not for the better.
The one thing that we need to mention is obesity. And that obesity is one of the biggest drivers of cancer. And here we are looking, breast cancer, prostate cancer, colorectal cancer, ovarian cancer, lung cancer. And it's the newest pandemic. And it's a global pandemic with the rate of obesity sitting now at more than 40% of the world's population is obese or overweight. And it's scary to see that obesity numbers in children is also sitting at 40%. So obesity being a driver of cancer, does that form part of lifestyle choices, or is it the fact that people are eating processed foods because they're cheaper, easier, they're not exercising, they're playing in front of screens instead of playing physically and actively. Do you think that's the biggest driving force, or is it pollution, like radiation or pesticides and stuff that's driving them, or can't we make a difference yet?
I think nobody really knows, and I think each one of those factors has a major, major role to play. If I had to say, I think lifestyle, or poor lifestyle or lifestyle factors probably plays the biggest role. And as you say, obesity is a huge, it's an epidemic at the moment. And it's, you know, it's quite crazy where we would consider traditionally you'd think that a wealthy society would have overweight, increased obesity issues, but we're actually seeing it in the lower socioeconomic groups now because processed food is cheaper, junk food is cheaper and easier. You know, your lower socioeconomic group people have to work harder for longer, so it's easier to get junk food than to go and prepare your fabulous whole food meal. So, and that's one of the reasons why we're seeing an absolute sort of skyrocketing in the incidence of cancer amongst the sort of the poorer populations as well, which is quite frightening.
So the next question that I need to ask you is, all the statistics that you pull online are American stuff. And I think all of us are tired of Americans. You know what? If you turn on the TV, either you hear about Trump or Harris or you know what. So what is the South African statistics?
So that's a very good question and nobody really knows. So there's been a huge discrepancy for a number of years, and it was possibly for almost two decades where our, what we call the National Cancer Registry was really just a non-entity. There was no mandatory reporting of cancer incidence and statistics, and so there just was there was no statistics for us. It has sort of been rejuvenated in the last over the last couple of years, but now it's too late, or should I say it's too early for us within the last.
What's happening now?
You know, possibly the statistics that they've managed to get for the last 5 years as to be able to tell us. You know, the way that the National Cancer Registry obtains its information traditionally has been through a voluntary sort of information that's provided by the pathology laboratories on a voluntary basis. They would either provide the information or they weren't obliged to. I think things like the Poppy Act has now made that even more difficult because now you're not allowed to share the information without permission. But instead of making cancer a
it should be a notifiable disease,
exactly. So you know if we have tuberculosis and all sorts of other diseases that are notifiable, then by law cancer should be as well, and it hasn't been, and it still isn't.
I find that alarming because how are you supposed to do proper education about the risks of cancer and preventing cancer? We're going to get to that a little bit later. So in your practice, seeing that we don't have statistics, in your practice, what are the most common cancers that you see? Can I guess?
Yeah, go for it.
Melanoma? Prostate cancer, breast, colon, lung.
Yeah, pretty spot on. So, you know, in clinical practice, basically, the most common cancers around the world are in women, breast cancer, lung cancer, colorectal cancer, and skin cancers. Cervix cancer tends to be there, but it's generally not an invasive because it's something that we can prevent. A large number of cervix cancers, although they're cancerous, are determined very early on, and so that's not a huge problem. In men, it's prostate cancer, colon cancer, lung cancer, and skin cancers. So we do tend to follow, in our clinical practice, we tend to follow the same sort of trends that we would get from the statistics from overseas. What is quite alarming, though, is that we're seeing a lot of these common cancers in a much younger patients.
Yes,
which
yes.
traditionally we haven't
yes.
seen.
Yes.
And that is the concerning factor.
I have recently just heard about a friend of mine whose sister at the age of 40 died of breast cancer, which, you know what, we know that our screening starts at the age of 45 for breast cancer. That's when they say, okay, now you need to start going to do your mammograms. But we see cancer diagnosed far earlier. So let's talk a little bit about breast cancer. It's probably one of the most common cancers, but I think it's quite misunderstood. If I ask you types of breast cancer, we know there's different types of breast cancer. And can you elaborate a little bit on that without confusing us too much?
Absolutely. So, you know, if we have to think about, and you're correct, breast cancer is probably the most common cancer or sort of invasive cancer in women. And if we have to think about what the breast is, the breast is just an organ which its sole real purpose, if we want to just talk medically, is to provide
perspective. It's not an artwork.
They are absolute artworks as well in a lot of cases. But the primary medical functional role of a breast is to produce milk for children. So the breast consists of the glands. We call the glandular tissue in the breast, which is what produces the milk. And it consists of pipes to carry the milk to the nipple.
Tubes.
And okay. Those are called the ducts. So if we have to broadly and very simply divide breast cancer into two groups, we have the most common form of breast cancer is something called ductal cancer, which is a cancer of those tubes or pipes. And then the second type of second most common type of breast cancer is something called lobular cancer, which is a cancer of the glands. They are both breast cancer. They do behave slightly differently, but they both still are considered breast cancer and are managed. They do get managed slightly differently, but that's broadly how we would talk about it. There are some very weird, rare types of breast cancers where you can get a cancer of the muscle in the breast, where you can get what's called a sarcoma or a cancer of the blood vessels in the breast, where you get an angiosarcoma. But those are extremely rare.
But you know what? They are more cancers not of the breast, but of
in the breast. But of other tissue, yeah.
So you often hear about cancers like triple negative or HER positive or HER negative. Can you elaborate a little bit on that?
So once we've now figured out whether the cancers come from the pipes, the ducts, or from the glands, the lobular cancer, we then want to look at the actual breast cells or the cancer cells themselves. And basically for 50 years, we knew that there was a potential driver of breast cancer in women, and that was the female hormones, estrogen and progesterone. And what we have on all of our cells are what we call receptors. Receptors, I always like to say, are almost just like switches, light switches. They can help to turn a cell, whether it's a healthy cell or a cancer cell, on or off. And so for many years, we knew that we would look for what we call the estrogen receptor or the progesterone receptor, because we know for a fact that the large proportion of breast cancers are driven or fed by the female hormones.
Okay,
so not necessarily.
My hand goes up because this just doesn't make sense. So females are genetically programmed to have hormones. So why haven't we evolved in a way that for hormones that is so necessary is causing cancer?
So it's a very good question, and because it doesn't make sense.
No.
But what we know is, and this is from donkey's years of studies into the risk factors for breast cancer. So if we had to take specific risk factors for women related to developing breast cancer, and we're not talking about the lifestyle factors and stuff that we spoke about earlier. Some of the most common sort of biggest risk factors for a woman developing breast cancer is a more chronic exposure to high levels of estrogen within her own body. And what does that mean? So Develops her first period at a young age. So traditionally,
this is younger than 13.
So this is younger than 13. So if a girl develops, we call it menarche, but she has her first period at the age of
10.
12 or 10 or 11, which we are seeing nowadays.
I'm seeing it a lot.
That's an independent risk factor for breast cancer.
Okay.
Women who go into menopause very late, and this again happens naturally. It's just one of those things. So if they go into menopause over the age of 50, 55, 60, they're at a higher risk of developing breast cancer. Women who don't have children, because when you have children, you have massive fluctuations of the hormones, but they're both up and down, and it's considered to be a protective factor. And women who have children late. So all of this basically tells
so
us
women
that
who have
so women who have children
has
late
a
have a higher risk of breast cancer. And all of this tells us or leads us to think that chronic exposure to higher levels of estrogen.
Is it
not
estrogen on its own or unopposed?
So it's
unopposed,
most likely
estrogens,
unopposed estrogen.
Because the estrogens is estradiol, estrone, and estriol.
Yeah, so it's most likely unopposed estrogens. And so we know that those are independent risk factors. So we know that breast cancer is driven, and it's an important word to say, driven by hormones, a large proportion. Not
driven,
caused,
not caused.
By,
and that's the big difference. Thank you for saying that.
Yes. So also women who take postmenopausal women who take hormone replacement therapy inappropriately at large levels, and we're talking here usually higher levels of estrogen hormone replacement as opposed to more progesterone-based, are also at higher risk. But it's a very nuanced discussion, and there's a large amount of controversy around the safety of it.
So I just want to jump in there, because this is the field that I work in, is menopausal hormone balancing. And I have to field that question in every single consultation. And if I don't have to field it, I actually bring it up. Now, so many studies have been done by different societies. And what baffles me is that the oncology societies and the menopausal societies differ. When we look, for instance, at the Women's Health Initiative study, which is one of the largest studies that have been done on this, on the safety of hormone replacement therapy, the findings is as follows. But if we take, and please, if you know of new data, please correct me.
No, absolutely.
If you take 10,000 women that's never been on hormone replacement therapy, 26 of them will develop breast cancer. So as you said, hormones might be a driver, but it's not the cause, because then everyone should have breast cancer. And you know what? If women who are not on hormone replacement therapy also develop breast cancer, it cannot be the sole cause.
No, not in the slightest.
So when we take a look at 10,000 women on hormone replacement therapy, 35 will develop breast cancer. So that makes it 9 more cases in 10,000 women, which is less than 1%, or less than 0.1% actually.
And I think that's where it needs to become a very, nowadays, it needs to become a very nuanced discussion. You are 100% correct in saying that the oncology society or community as a whole have always been very opposed to hormone replacement therapy. I think inappropriately so, but traditionally they were very opposed to it. And I think one of the reasons for that was, you know, we're talking a doctrine that was developed 30, 40 years ago. Where the only hormone replacement therapy was Premarin. There was only pure estrogen as a hormone replacement therapy. None of the newer molecules, the balanced, and you said something earlier where your primary focus is hormone balancing. Nothing was balanced. And so I think for many years when women were receiving pure estrogen, Premarin, for prolonged periods of time, yes. possibly at excessive doses because it made them feel great. There absolutely was a sort of possibly a majorly increased risk of breast cancer. I don't believe that that's the case anymore. You know, the hormone replacement is an art in itself, a science in itself. And I'm not versed in it because we don't traditionally do it because we've been so opposed to it. But it has become, in my opinion, and I think a large number of a large proportion of the oncology society, that it has become a lot more acceptable.
Yeah, I think what people need to understand, and we tend to forget this, when you and I were in the same class in med school, but you know what, 30 years ago, if your grandparents lived to 60, 65, they were old.
Exactly.
And you know what, if you heard of someone in their 70s, they were really, really old. And today I actually saw articles over the past week where they're expecting our life expectancy to be beyond 100 by 2050. So that's 25 years from now. We're going to live beyond 100, but our biology does not change. Our bodies doesn't change how it works. We're not going to keep on producing hormones for longer. That doesn't change. So our life expectancy will change.
And I think
and
that's
the symptoms of hormone imbalances are becoming worse and worse. And we can address it safely, but you have to do it responsibly. There's a time and a duration and modalities that define the safety.
Oh, absolutely.
Owen, I want to ask you about genes.
Yeah.
So breast cancer genes, we know about BRCA1 and BRCA2 and all the other genes, and explain them to us in a little bit more detail.
So, you know, breast cancer, genetic breast cancer, if you want to put it that way, the genetic risk for developing breast cancer is actually a very small percentage of breast cancers. And by when I say the genetic risks, it's because we really only do know of two sort of really significant genetic abnormalities, and that is the BRCA1 and BRCA2. BRCA forms probably 5% of breast cancer cases. But having said that, when we talk the difference between hereditary or familial versus genetic, breast cancer definitely is a familial hereditary cancer. And by saying that, so if your mother's had breast cancer, you're at a significantly higher risk, or a close first sort of degree relative has had breast cancer, you're at significantly higher risk. So there must be other genes. We just don't know what they are yet. And so when we talk about this sort of genetic risk, we're talking about 5% of breast cancers. There are other syndromes that are associated with a number of different types of cancers within a single person. But again, we don't necessarily have a specific genetic test for it. It is very important, if there is a strong family history, to sort of go for genetic counseling and try and see if you can determine which tests and which genetic abnormalities there are. But realistically, all cancer is caused by some sort of genetic abnormality. It's just whether it's hereditary, passed on, or whether it's caused de novo by exposure to some sort of toxin, poor lifestyle, or whatever you want to call it.
Okay, so if I understand you correctly, I beg your pardon, we have genetics, but genetic and familial trait is different. Genetic is you were passed.
You were passed on a gene specific abnormal gene. Yes,
and familial is, it runs in the family.
We just don't know which gene to look for yet.
Okay, so would you suggest screening for BRCA genes in your patients?
So the easy short answer is no. Obviously, we do suggest it, and we suggest it in very specific areas or categories. As I said, BRCA gene is not common. Occurs in 5% of breast cancer patients. So if we had to extrapolate that out into the population, it's probably going to be less than 0.01% of the population. And so to do a BRCA test as a screening test, for example, is just not financially viable. It's an extremely expensive test. And if you're doing that just as a screening test, you're using a very expensive test to look for cancer, which occurs in 5% of cancer patients. But if I have a patient that sits down in front of me who has been diagnosed with breast cancer, and she's either very young, she has a very aggressive type of breast cancer, or we know that she's got a strong family history, then we absolutely do then say it's quite important that we do this genetic workup and screening for two reasons. You know, if you do fall into that sort of risk category, which makes us think that you could possibly have the BRCA gene, then you are at an extremely high risk of developing other cancers, ovarian cancer, uterine cancer. So we then want to be able to offer you the most appropriate preventative measures going forward, having bilateral mastectomies, considering having your ovaries and your uterus taken out at a young age.
See, that one doesn't make sense because we know that in those patients, hormones can be a driver. But removing the ovaries, you put them at a very young age into a surgical menopause. When I see them in my practice, it's it's hell for those patients.
It's absolute hell.
And now we need to treat them, our treatments are limited.
No, I 100% agree. But I think what's important to sort of differentiate there is that with a woman who has BRCA positive breast cancer, for example, we're not advocating to have her ovaries taken out to reduce her estrogen. We're advocating to have her ovaries taken out because the risk of ovarian cancer is something like 10 times the average risk. And ovarian cancer is often a subtle cancer which is difficult to diagnose at an early stage.
Yeah.
And quite often they get diagnosed at a late stage. And so in that case, we're wanting to be able to say, look, we don't want you. You may have to go through chemotherapy and radiation for your breast cancer, but we don't want you in 5 years' time to now have to go through chemotherapy again for an ovarian cancer after you've had surgery, and then possibly a third time for your uterine cancer. So in that case, we're wanting to be able to offer them the chance or the opportunity to possibly remain cancer-free and not develop a second or third type of cancer. So it's a very different situation. It's not fun having your estrogen taken away in any aspect. But we would rather for a young woman at the age of 30 say, look, we'll manage your hormones as best as we can, but we can hopefully guarantee that you won't develop a second or third cancer. Doing the BRCA testing is also, it needs to be done responsibly. There's a lot of counseling around it. It doesn't just affect you as the patient. It affects your entire family line, your siblings, your children. So it needs to be managed with very carefully and with a lot of respect.
Yeah, when it comes to gene testing, and when my patients come and they've done thousands of rands worth of genetic testing and they plonk it in front of me, it looks like a textbook. And I say to them, okay, now what?
That's the biggest problem, yeah.
Now what? You have the genes. Now what? We can't change them. The only thing that you can do is live a healthy lifestyle, stop smoking, stop drinking, exercise well, have a good diet, stay out of the sun, sleep enough, manage your stress levels. Okay, but then why did I do all these tests? Okay, you tell me. You're the one that paid for them.
And that's the problem. So, you know, if we when we are sort of referring a patient for whatever form of cancer it is for genetic screening, there's a large, a whole amount, a huge amount of counseling that goes into it. What is unfortunate nowadays is that you can buy a DNA test over the internet and it comes back with, as you say, 10,000 different genes, which half of us don't know if it's relevant or not. And there's no thought going into, if your test comes back positive, who has warned you or explained to you why you did the test and what the implications of that
and,
are.
And what you and then what are you what, going, what to, you're do going to do about it?
Yeah. So it's, you know, it's like a, you know, there's, it's completely unrelated to cancer, but there's a disease called Huntington's, which is hereditary. It is fatal in the long term. And, you know, you've got to always decide, do you want to, if you've got it, do your children want to know that they're going to die in 10 years' time? Or would they rather just carry on with their lives and wait and see what happens? So I think we've always got to be very cautious, even over-testing, over-investigating. I mean, even when we're looking at screening for breast cancer, you know, and we see the same with prostate cancer. Sometimes if you are going for a mammogram twice a year, you can actually find, you can be over-investigated, you can find an early little cancer spot which the body may have dealt with on its own. And so there has been a lot of research done into sort of over the harm, actually the harm that mammograms can do because of the anxiety and the, so we've got to be very cautious when we're talking about screening and testing patients.
So I'm going to get to screening just now, but what are the signs and symptoms of breast cancer? What should women be looking out for?
So the most important thing that women should be doing is feeling their breasts.
Well, you know what? I always say that the husbands diagnose breast lumps.
The husbands
first.
As well. You know, we always from a medical point of view recommend that a woman is comfortable and knows her own breasts. Absolutely, your partner, male, female, should also be comfortable and should know your breasts. But the most important thing that a woman can do is to know her own breasts. It is very common to have benign lumps in breasts. It's very it happens all the time, and so it's very important for a woman to be able to be aware of what's happening in her breast, and then if there's a change, to be able to seek advice. Because often, so you asked, what are the signs and symptoms? Often the signs or symptoms will be negligible. Once a woman becomes aware of the fact that she's got breast cancer, and having said this, it happens in men as well, but once a woman becomes aware, it's often quite advanced.
Yes.
You know, if you've got particularly women who have large, voluptuous breasts, you can end up having a tennis ball-sized tumor in your breast and not be aware of it if you're not examining. And so once you are developing symptoms, pain, swelling, redness, discharge from the nipple, it's often quite late and quite advanced.
Or, you know what, I remember that expression, pudor orange, where the skin starts dimpling, yeah. It actually looks like orange peel.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. And that's,
it's too late.
Well, it's not, you know, well, not necessarily too advanced. Late, but it's a much more advanced, yes. Mm-hmm. And so then we're heading into the, you know, throwing the book at you with chemo, radiation, surgery, whereas if we find a breast cancer very early on, you often can avoid possibly all the treatments except surgery.
So, Owen, what we need to get across is self-breast examination is essential on an ongoing basis. There are websites that show you how to do it, but your primary healthcare provider, whether it's a clinic sister or your doctor, should be able to show you as well. I think if we can just pass a couple of tips along, it should always be done with the flat fingers, not if you can see me, it's not doing that. It's flat fingers like that. The breast is divided into four quadrants. We start in each and we feel and go around and feel for anything. And then the upper quadrant on the lateral side, on the outside, This is the most important one because the breast tissue extends all the way up into VAM.
Absolutely.
And in the axil, and you know what we need to feel around there. And this is exactly the same for men. So if we talk about breast cancer for men, how common is this?
So it's not common. So, I mean, if you had to put it on the list of common cancers for men, it would be down, you know, past number 10.
But it's aggressive if it comes to men.
So it tends to be more aggressive. It tends to be found in a more advanced state, primarily because men don't have large breasts. And so it often, by the time, firstly, most men that find a lump will just ignore it. It may be misdiagnosed as something called gynecomastia, which is just sometimes an overgrowth of breast tissue. And so it's often more advanced, invasive, invaded into the chest muscles itself, and it tends to be more aggressive, yeah.
So if we look at men, morphology, who's the typical guy? Is it the guy with man boobs or is it any guy?
It's any guy. And so that's the scary thing, is that we can risk stratify women and say, you know, early periods, all sorts of stuff. With men, it can happen in anybody. But probably where the biggest risk factor for men would be a close female relative with breast cancer.
I know that BRCA genes are also sometimes related to prostate cancer.
Yeah, absolutely.
So if you have a strong history of prostate cancer on the male side of the family, is your risk for developing breast cancer slightly elevated? Is this something that you need to be aware of?
We're not seeing that there's if there's a strong risk, family history of prostate cancer, that there's an associated increased risk of breast cancer within the family. But and we don't do BRCA testing on all men with prostate cancer either, but if you develop prostate cancer at a young age, and again, we are seeing it now at younger ages.
I've seen patients as young as 20.
Yeah, absolutely. Then we absolutely now we would look at saying doing the BRCA testing, and in this instance, if the male relative tests positive for BRCA, then we need to consider testing his female siblings or his children in general, because it does then associate with the same risks. So,
okay, detection and screening. We spoke about self-examination, screening. I think, you know, with these different opinions, we're starting to see breast cancer earlier and earlier, and yet the World Health Organization still recommends that we only start screening normally from about 45 with mammograms. Do you think it's still valid to say only start screening at 45, or would you say, if there's anyone in your female line that you should maybe start screening earlier with visualization tests, or just focus on self-examination?
So I think everybody should self-examine, and that's just on a weekly basis. You should just get to know your breasts, and that's going to be the most important, earliest tool that we can do. The reason that the screening guidelines recommend starting with mammogram screenings sort of over the age of 40 is really because a young breast is quite dense. So it's a very dense, thick tissue, which they found that the success rate of mammograms in a younger, dense breast is significantly lower. And so there's a much higher risk of possibly missing
something,
or possibly overdiagnosing, because when you're doing a mammogram, you're basically taking an X-ray. It's literally just an X-ray, and I'm sure any woman who's had it will want to kill me because it's not a comfortable test. They take your breast and they squeeze it between two plates, but it's literally just an X-ray of that breast tissue. On that X-ray, they're looking for increased density. So something that, you know, if you ever look at an X-ray, you'll see black and white. We're looking for something that's very intensely white. Now, the problem if you've got very thick, young breast tissue is that everything's just going to look white. And so you may miss an early tumor, or you may overdiagnose and put a poor young woman through 10 needle biopsies or an operation to cut something out that's not really there. So it is, we do still recommend it for a woman who has a close family relative that had breast cancer, and what I would normally recommend would be roughly 10 years younger than the age at which your mother or sister developed breast cancer.
Okay.
Obviously, unless you're already at the age of 40 or 50, and then you would it would be part of your normal screening.
So I have a question. When you explain exactly how they do a mammogram, I often wonder if you have a tumor that sits closer to the chest wall, does it pick up on the mammogram? So what my question is how sensitive and accurate is a mammogram?
So
is it still the gold standard?
So it is still the gold standard. It's far from perfect, but it is still the gold standard. And when we're talking about as a screening test, it is the gold standard, without a doubt.
Okay.
Now, as a diagnostic test, so if we're looking to say, is there a better test that can diagnose a cancer or a tumor, not necessarily a cancer, but that can pick up or image, see a tumor in a breast? Yes, absolutely. A breast MRI is probably at the moment considered to be the gold standard in terms of visualizing the breast tissue.
Unfortunately, it's unaffordable.
But it's ridiculous. Yeah, you're looking, a screening test by definition needs to be relatively cheap, relatively freely available, and non-invasive. And an MRI scanner is not freely available, and it's ridiculously expensive. Sometimes up to 1,000 times the cost of a mammogram. So it is still considered the gold standard, but it's not perfect. The studies that were done basically in terms of screening to recommend mammograms, we still look at from 30 years ago, saying that the highest sensitivity of a mammogram will be for women between the ages of 60 to 70.
Mm.
As we go down in the decades then, 50 to 60, 40 to 50, we're finding that the success rate and the sensitivity drops. And that is purely due to the fact that the breast tissue is still relatively dense and it's easier to miss. Having said that, it is still the gold standard. And it's like anything else in life, I think anything else in medicine particularly, provided you are going to a reputable a mammogram center where you've got an experienced radiologist that knows what they're looking for, then that is an independent factor that will increase the sensitivity.
Absolutely. I can't agree with that more. So thermal scanning and breast sonars use?
Absolutely. So breast sonars particularly are of use. They're generally not particularly useful on their own. We will most commonly use a breast sonar if on mammogram there is a concerning spot, then the breast sonar will be easier to be able to identify it. Breast sonar can also look underneath the arm to look for lymph nodes if there's a suspicion that there could be swollen lymph nodes, whereas a mammogram won't see that. And then in particularly in my practice, women who've had breast cancer, have had mastectomies and have had reconstruction with implants, then an ultrasound is quite useful to be able to have a look around the implant, whereas the mammogram may not be as sensitive. Thermography is still up in the air. It's a recognized screening test by the FDA, which around the world is considered to be the doyen of what we accept, but the evidence for it is still not as good. So we would not consider that to be the gold standard, although it has its uses without a doubt.
Okay, so self-examination, know your breasts and notice change.
Yeah.
And that's what leads to suspicion if there's anything
Absolutely.
That changes.
So stand in front of the mirror. If your one breast suddenly is a little bit higher than it used to be, feel it. Any tenderness, but it's because we are screening tests we know are not perfect. Your hand is the best.
So you get the diagnosis of a suspicious lesion. They usually go and do an MRI or a biopsy. And now you get the diagnosis you have breast cancer. What now?
So it's obviously it's a devastating devastating diagnosis. It's a life-changing diagnosis. And ideally, a situation like that needs to be handled very tensitively and carefully. Doesn't necessarily always happen, unfortunately, but basically normally what would happen is you get the diagnosis and you will be referred to see a breast surgeon in most instances.
So surgeon first before oncologist?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. And it's not inappropriate in any way, but most commonly the GP that sent you for the mammogram or the radiographer that's done the mammogram will suggest that you go and see a breast surgeon. And then the breast surgeon will confirm the diagnosis, obviously from the pathology, and then we'll make an assessment with regards to the stage of the cancer. Is it just an early stage, isolated little tumor in the breast? Has it spread into the lymph nodes? Has it possibly spread into the rest of the body? And all of the sort of process from there in terms of deciding on the treatment really depends on that staging or how advanced the cancer is at the start.
So next week I've invited Dr. Vivian Jandero, who's a plastic and reconstructive surgeon, to come and talk to us about the surgery aspect of stuff, but more so the reconstructive side. Yeah. Treatment, Owen. Treatment can be varied, as you said. We're not going to go into specifics. There's no time, and every single patient would be different.
No, absolutely.
But what are the options?
But broadly speaking, so what we would look at when we start would be a couple of things in terms of deciding the most appropriate treatment. The size of the tumor at the start. And then what we call the biology of the tumor. What type of cancer is it and how aggressive is it?
So is this the HERS and the triple negative?
So this is when we're looking at.
So which one is the worst, or isn't there a differentiation?
So if we had to look traditionally, what we call the triple negative breast cancer, which basically means that when we look under the microscope, the pathologists can tell us that it doesn't have those little switches that can turn it on, for estrogen, progesterone, and then there's a third molecule called HER2. So it doesn't have any of those. And those tend to be more aggressive cancers. They tend to be much faster growing, basically because they're growing without having anything that's stimulating them to grow.
So you can't withdraw or block.
Yeah, exactly.
The driver, it's there.
Yeah, you know, if you've got a hormone positive cancer, you can think of it almost as being a stupid cancer. It needs the hormones, or it needs something to tell it to grow. Whereas the triple negative breast cancers, they've developed on their own, they've learned how to grow and mutate and multiply without needing any stimulation. So traditionally, those tend to be the most aggressive. And in that regard, then, if you've got a more aggressive cancer, in a lot of cases, we would recommend starting before surgery, starting with chemotherapy, in order to be able to shrink the cancer, get it as small as possible. And in some cases, we're very fortunate in that we're actually able to get rid of all of the cancer with chemotherapy. We still go and do an operation to make sure that there are no cancer cells left there. But if we can tell you that even before you're going in for your operation, that all of the cancer is gone, we can then predict that your prognosis going forward is going to be fantastic. So the more aggressive the cancers, the more we'll tend to start with chemotherapy first to try and prevent them from spreading and to be able to offer a better prognosis. But the less aggressive types of cancers, if it's a small tumor, then we would look at doing an operation first. And the operations can either be what is called a breast-conserving surgery. We used to call them lumpectomies, mm-hmm. where you just go and remove the tumor with an area of healthy tissue around it. And they would take out usually what's called a sentinel lymph node, which is the first or second little lymph node underneath your arm to just assess.
To see if it's gone
make sure
all the way up there or not.
To see whether it hasn't, because that would then determine if you possibly do need treatment afterwards, like chemotherapy. And then it can extend all the way to a mastectomy, and often that is a patient's preference. Once you've had the surgery, then in certain cases, if it was a more advanced cancer, so a larger tumor, or if there was signs of the cancer spreading into the lymph nodes, then we would offer radiation therapy as well.
Okay. So we need to understand prognosis. Prognosis means what is your chances of survival?
Yeah.
Okay. So what is the prognosis for breast cancer? I know it's going to vary according to the stage, the type of cancer, lifestyle, etc., etc. But on average, what is the lifetime prognosis for surviving breast cancer? I mean, what's the 5-year survival rate that we see at the moment?
So if we talk about prognosis, the prognosis for breast cancer should be excellent on a whole. You know, it's a cancer which we understand very well. It's a cancer which it's the most studied and investigated cancer on the planet. Our treatments have advanced to in phenomenal ways. So a woman who has got an early stage breast cancer, stage 1 or stage 2, who undergoes whatever appropriate treatment is recommended, has an excellent prognosis. We're talking more than 95% survival over 5 years, more than 90% at 10 years, extending onwards sort of indefinitely. The later a cancer is diagnosed, and we won't necessarily talk about stage 4 cancer where it's already spread, but if you've got a stage 3 tumor where the cancer is now significantly bigger or it has spread into the lymph nodes, even with appropriate treatment now, unfortunately that prognosis tends to come down because there's a significantly higher risk of the cancer coming back, but it's still an excellent prognosis. So if we talk about your 5-year survival for somebody with stage 3 breast cancer who has appropriate treatment, we're still talking 80 to 85% 5-year survival. And so if it's caught early enough and treated appropriately, a woman with breast cancer can have an excellent prognosis. Unfortunately, what we do find is that it often is diagnosed late, misdiagnosed. And unfortunately, the reality of our country, and I think a large proportion of the world, is that a lot of women of lower socioeconomic means don't have access to, well, screening, but also access to appropriate healthcare. So, you know, if you're out in a rural area, even if you know that you've got a lump and that lump's growing, you often get passed along from one clinic to the next clinic, and it can take a while before you get to the appropriate. And then your prognosis obviously is significantly worse. So in a first world setting where you've got excellent screening or appropriate screening and access to all of the appropriate treatments, breast cancer has got an excellent prognosis.
Okay. So the last thing, prevention. How do I prevent breast cancer? And I think we've answered this question when we spoke about genes and what causes cancer. But what are the most important things that we should either not do or stop doing?
So I think you answered it very well when you said, you know, you have patients coming with that genetic test of 10,000 genes. The question to say is breast cancer has always been around. So back in ancient Egypt, there's evidence of women having breast cancer. It's always been around, but it's the incidence which is obviously greater. So what can we do to prevent it? We can't change our genetics. If you do know that you've got a specific BRCA gene, yes, then you can think about doing quite radical surgeries. But otherwise, you've got to change your lifestyle. If you're wanting to prevent any cancer, the first change is lifestyle modification. Exercise. Combat obesity, eat appropriately, don't smoke. As simple as
alcohol,
getting...
Alcohol is a big one.
Alcohol is a big one, and particularly excessive alcohol.
Yeah.
I always joke, and I think it changes every year. You know, 1 year you'll have a study coming out saying that a glass of whiskey will increase your lifespan by 10 years, and then the next year it's a glass of red wine, and then a year later all alcohol is bad.
So I think everything
in moderation, as far as I'm concerned. But excessive alcohol, without a doubt, is associated with an increased risk of all cancers. across
so
the board.
I in the Women's Health Initiative study, I also read that, and maybe you can comment on this. Your risk for developing breast cancer, drinking 2 units of alcohol per day, is higher than the risk of developing breast cancer with appropriate hormone balancing and optimization.
Absolutely, yeah.
So, you know, but then that's, I think that's something that we need to understand. Your risk for developing breast cancer when you are overweight, not even obese, is higher than your risk of developing breast cancer with appropriate and timely hormone replacement therapy.
Absolutely. So these are things that you can do. And, you know, another thing you can do is appropriate hormone balancing. You know, is once you are in the menopausal or postmenopausal stage, is to seek a professional like yourself who does it, who knows what they're doing and can balance your hormones appropriately as necessary and safely, rather than getting something from the person at the gym who says they can make you feel better or you know, so it even includes medical interventions where necessary in terms of reducing your risks.
Absolutely. Treating metabolic disease and obesity is tantamount to preventing any kind of cancer.
Absolutely.
So, Owen, I want to thank you. It was really enlightening. I work in this field and I've learned a lot from you today. You've made it understandable and digestible. If anyone who listens to this wants to get hold of you, how do they get hold of your practice?
So we've got a website, nozwithioncology.com. We are based in Dunkeld in Johannesburg, 20 Kent Road on the corner of Kent and Jan Smuts. Our phone number is 011-482-3593, and you are more than welcome. Anybody's welcome to come through for we don't have the screening, we don't have the mammograms, but for consultations or advice, with pleasure.
So from us here at the Tea Health Show, thank you for listening. If you want more information, you can take a look at our website, The Tea Clinic, www.theteaclinic.com. You can call us on 010-824-1393. And next week, we'll be back and we're going to talk about what happens after a diagnosis of breast cancer and any kind of surgical intervention that might have to happen or even reconstruction. I'll be joined by Dr. Vivian Jandera. Until next time, I wish you all the best in health.
That was the Tea Health Show, empowering you with knowledge. Download all previous episodes on your favorite podcast platform. The Tea Health Show is brought to you by Tea Clinic.